On this season 5 premiere of the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, we have a new logo, we have a new format, and we have a new team member and co-host, plus your favorite maniacal movie maniac, Edgegrave Dave, reviews my favorite Friday the 13th film, Friday the 13th Part 7, A New Blood, and his awesome tribute to Ultimate Final Girl, Laura Park Lincoln. So let's get it started.
Do aliens exist and are they among us? Are weird creatures lurking in the darkness? Do evil entities hide in the shadows of your bedroom while you sleep? Join us as we explore all this and more on the Warped Reality Podcast.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Warped Reality Paranormal Podcast, Season 5, Episode 1. This is the Friday the 13th episode. I hope you guys are going to enjoy this. We have an awesome show. And I'd like to introduce you to a new co-host of the show, Mr. Ken. He just wants to be called Ken. It's very simple, nice, simple. Ken. I like that.
How you doing, everybody? I'm Ken. Nice to talk to you.
That's right. We have a pretty awesome topic for this show. We're going to be going into this one topic pretty extensively, hopefully. And talk to you a little bit about the exorcism of Roland Doe. So yeah, this is a big one. If you don't know that name, or if you don't know what the exorcism of Roland Doe is, I assure you, you definitely do. Especially if you're listening to this, you definitely know the story. You just don't know that it's with this kid. So we're going to get right into it right now, man. So Ken, can you start it off?
Yeah, man. So, basically, in January of 1949, there was a 14-year-old boy who lived in Maryland, and some weird things started happening with him. His aunt had just died, and he was very close with his aunt. And she had taught him, she was a spiritualist, so she taught him how to use a Ouija board. She actually purchased the Ouija board for him. And after she passed, he was pretty heartbroken, and then weird stuff started happening. They started hearing scratching on floors and just all kinds of weird things happening. It's a really cool story. There's several aliases for Roland Doe. Is, by the way, there's Roland Doe and Robbie Mannheim, and then his real name was Ronald Edward Hunkler. So yeah, lots of names, or you could just call it what everybody knows it by. Which is from a very famous movie in the 70s and possibly one of the scariest movies ever, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah. We might as well just come out and say it. It's the story of the Exorcist. Now, mind you, of course, we know that The Exorcist was the movie in the book by William Peter Blatty, was with a girl named Reagan. But they changed around a few things to, to appeal to the masses and stuff, just to change around the story also, because, the real family wanted anonymity.
Anonymity.
they didn't want it to get out there. They wanted it to be private. They didn't want with this case, with the real case, it actually did get a lot of press when it was going on. And I mean, it was hard for them, that's why they had to come up with all these aliases and stuff.
Could you imagine that though, with one of your kids having some weird shit like that happening with them? And basically all hell is breaking loose quite literally. And right. Who in the hell would want to be famous for that? And not to mention the fact that the kid is 14 years old, and how's he going to live life after that? I guess in today's standards, though, people would just record it and put it on TikTok, and it would be the best thing ever, probably,
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and with the, where you said his Aunt Harriet had died, and she was he was very, very close to her, and she taught him how to use the Ouija board and all that stuff. And if you remember in the movie, Reagan, it's kind of a small part, I guess, in it, because a lot of people kind of fast forward through the first hour of The Exorcist, because it is a little bit drawn out, of the movie. It's slow moving. It's a slow build, but I mean, it's an amazing movie. And she uses the Ouija board. And actually, here's a fun fact, Ken. Now, she talks to somebody on the Ouija board. And when her mom says, well, who are you talking to? She said, I'm talking to Captain Howdy.
Yeah.
Right? Captain Howdy was actually Dee Snider's name in the movie Strangelands.
Yep.
He used that for that.
Which is
a lot of people don't
movie.
Actually put that together.
Great movie.
Oh, it's an amazing movie.
Yeah.
That's an amazing movie. I mean, I wish he would have made more of those. He was awesome in that. He should have did more horror stuff.
Agreed.
You know? Yeah, he did that role so good. And yeah, so he did it was Captain Howdy. And she, of course, I believe that she wanted to do the Ouija board with her mom, and then the planchette just like went, like when her mom tried to touch the planchette, it like went away.
Yeah.
You know, like it moved. But yeah, that movie is still one of my favorites. You know, definitely considered the scariest movie of all time. But the real story isn't much isn't less scary. I mean, it's insane, some of the stuff that happened.
Yeah, it's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, the family had reported furniture shifting and vases flying, and like you had said, the scratching sounds. I believe that they said that the first thing that they started hearing was some kind of dripping noise. And that was coming out of nowhere, and they couldn't find where this dripping noise was coming from. And, you know, just like pretty much, I mean, if you hear about demonic possessions and stuff like that, it starts off slow and then it just like progresses.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much, I mean, it's classic kind of what happened here. And
so they heard the dripping, which I thought was fascinating. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I thought this was fascinating because they kept hearing the dripping. And by the way, in the real story, I guess the mother did use the Ouija board with her son after the aunt died. And that's when they started hearing these noises, because they actually thought that they contacted their aunt, his aunt, which was what they were trying to do with the Ouija board. They started hearing the drippings, which was pretty fascinating. But these lasted for a couple of days, I think they said. And then their attention was drawn to a picture of Jesus on the wall. And that's where they thought the dripping was coming from, I guess. And then the picture just started shaking and vibrating. And that really is what was the whole thing that set everything off, the catalyst, kind of say.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, and people were even saying that that witnesses had claimed that the bed was moving, just like in the movie, you know, the bed was moving and shaking, and guttural voices were coming out of Roland and all this stuff. And, you know, they had tried, the first thing that they had done was they got in touch with first off, they were Lutheran, and they had gotten in touch with, I'm trying to find it here, Father Hughes in Washington, D.C. Now, they're from Maryland, so not too far from Washington, D.C. And they had gotten in touch with Father Hughes, and he tried as much as he could, and he just couldn't, he couldn't do what, I guess, you know, what had to be done. So they handed him off to a couple of other priests over in, where did they go now? They kind of traveled a lot with this too. They actually ended up going into some sort of like hospital that was run by monks, actually. And they had, you know, for I believe it was about a month, they were doing extensive, you know, exorcism, you know, rites on him and stuff. And it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And I mean, crazy things were happening. Like, just, again, just like in the movie, you know, they started seeing words forming on his chest and his stomach, as if somebody was writing on the inside of his chest. You know, he would have superhuman strength and try and attack the priests that were trying to do this. So actually, though, there was one priest. He was supposedly involved, and he was one of the last ones that actually to survive, you know, after everybody had kind of passed away from this. And he actually says that he can't really claim that what happened actually happened. Because what he said was, he's like, I didn't really see anything supernatural. So he goes, I can't really say if it was or if it wasn't. You wonder if he's just saying that just to kind of still protect, you know, everything that's going on with the family and stuff. But some of the stuff here, though, was just insane. His name was Halloran.
Yeah, there's all kinds of creepy things that, that happened. I mean, you know, basically, really following suit with the movie. I mean, there were chairs sliding, dressers rocking, dishes flying. And this is all before they took him to their Lutheran, what was it? What is he, a reverend? And then after they did, see, the story that I, the background that I read on it was that that preacher or reverend, whatever he is, actually didn't believe it. So he said, you know, let Roland stay with me for a night. And if something supernatural happens, then sure, something supernatural happened. And I guess he woke up in the middle of the night and was screaming and all kinds of crazy stuff happened and he couldn't get him to calm down and chairs were flying and he actually had to physically tie Roland to the chair and for the night. And he broke that as well. Roland broke the chair as well. So it wasn't like he just, you know, I don't know how to do this. He really tried. And then it was kind of beyond what he, you know, what he was able to do or had been trained to do or whatever. And that's when they handed them off to, you know, this priest and that priest. And I think there were, what, three or four that were actually involved, like main priests. Yep. But yeah, they were seeing, he had words like evil and hell and no, all scratched into him. And then they would just like disappear the next day. It was pretty neat. And, you know, a lot of these occurrences are heavily, heavily documented in by several, over 48 witnesses to some of these things. You know, I mean, that's not no joke, man.
Yeah, no. And then after an intense, like, I believe it was something like 28 days, you know, I mean, it got to the point where at one point when the exorcisms were going on every day and they were really trying to get, you know, this demon out of him. Now, mind you, the demon kept saying that he was the devil himself, you know, so it wasn't like it was some kind of demon. Now, again, though, from what I've talked to about, you know, with demonologists, they say that, you know, these demons, they lie and they say, oh, I'm the devil or I'm Satan. And they, you know, they're basically just doing that to scare you. But in this case, some of the stuff that was going on, it kind of makes a lot of sense that maybe it was kind of a high ranking, whatever.
So do you know why they moved to St. Louis?
Well, no, it was basically just because they wanted to go with these two other priests. And actually St. Louis was, they had family there. So they wanted to be closer to their family. So that's why they went out there. And that's,
I guess the night before that, they decided to really, they were talking about moving to St. Louis. And then the night that they were talking about that, his parents, I guess the word Lewis formed on his chest, scratched on his chest. And that's when they decided that's where they were going. I don't know why the hell they had listened
to that. Why would you listen to that?
Demon tell them where to go, but they did, you know?
But you wonder though, you wonder if maybe that was Roland that was writing those words, you know, because he couldn't communicate like that. So maybe, you know, cause he was kind of inside his body still. Maybe it was him that was telling them to do that. You know,
very good point. Maybe it was him that was writing most of that stuff because most of that stuff isn't really that threatening. I mean, he's saying evil, he's saying hell, he's got had no written on him. Maybe it was him. That's a really good point,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I had seen it. There are actually a lot of exorcisms that still go on to this day, actually.
Have you ever seen one? Like actually watched like a video of a supposed exorcism, because there are some out there. They aren't really done by they're done by like an offshoot of the Catholic religion. It's a part of Catholicism, but it's a different part. And I've seen some exorcisms from them because the real Catholic Church won't put that out there. You know, they won't, which is pretty cool. I mean, I agree with them not doing that because First of all, only big dumbasses like me want to see it, actually see it. You know, nobody else wants to see it but me.
There was, you know, another famous one was the exorcism of Annalise Michel.
Yep.
And that, when I tell you, like I did a quick, I believe it was a TikTok or something about it. And oh no, I played the recording of her exorcisms. I played it on my show. When I tell you, man, like as soon as I played it on my show, I deleted it straight off of my computer. I'm like, yeah. I don't want any part of this. You know?
Yeah.
And that was so frightening.
Yeah, it's scary. Even
the screams, the stuff that she was saying, that like, man, like that can't be human. You know, it was nuts. You know, but they do have, I mean, they still perform hundreds per year.
Yep.
Priests, you know, for exorcisms and stuff. Now, mind you, again, a lot of them are, you know, a lot of them tend to be, you know, mental issues and stuff like that. And as we had talked once before, you know, that still could help, because if the person legitimately believes that they're, you know, demonically possessed and you do the rites on them, you know, it might still actually cure them from that mental illness, you know?
Yeah.
So it could still work like that, but there have been cases, I've covered them too. There have been cases where people have tried to expel demons from other people, even a toddler, and they ended up killing the people because they either tied, I think in one case, they tied a nun that they thought was possessed. They tied her to a tree for like days and she ended up starving to death. You know, like crazy, crazy stuff.
There's another case over in England. I think his name was Kennedy Ife. He died. His parents just got cleared just like months ago of because they were putting them murder charges on his parents and neglect and all kinds of stuff. And dude, it's, I think that's part of the game too. You know, I think that's part of the game because things have changed, obviously. And I think that probably there's more put into nowadays into mental health and really examining that than there was back in 1949, as far as these cases go. There's a lot, there's gloves now, you know, that they put on when they do these things, I think. But yeah, man, I mean, it's really crazy that I don't know. It's really crazy that people are dying from this. And in a lot of cases, it's a balancing act of whose fault that is, or if it was a real phenomena that killed them, or if it was the neglect or just what they were, you know, just what they were doing to them during the exorcism.
After they had done, when they were doing the final exorcism, actually on the last day for Roland Doe. Now this was probably 28, 29 days into the last, you know, point where he was in the hospital and they were doing all these rites and stuff. There was a recorded voice of him shouting, "Satan is here." And right after that, they said that he kind of went into some sort of trance. And then when he woke up, he said, "He's gone." And that was pretty much it. And he actually ended up living a pretty normal life after that.
And that's kind of what I want to talk about, because he did. That was my whole point of this Roland Doe thing, because it's a fascinating story and there's lots of crazy stuff that go into it. And there's a lot of people, there's even one of the, as you mentioned, one of the priests that said that they didn't really necessarily believe because they didn't see anything supernatural happen. And that's one of the things that you've got to really examine. I think his real words were, he did nothing out of the ordinary that a 14-year-old boy couldn't do. Okay. How many 14-year-old boys you know that are speaking fluent Latin? It's been a dead language for years. You know what I mean? When I was 14, there was no way in hell I was going to learn Latin. I didn't even want to learn English when I was 14. Right. You know what I mean? Like, there's still some things though that go against him saying that. I get his point of view and I understand that he didn't see it, but is this kid scratching himself and they're going away the next day? You know, he's speaking fluent Latin and out of nowhere, you know, at fluent Latin. He's you're talking to him because the rites of exorcism are done in Latin. You're speaking to him in Latin and he's talking back to you just fluently. I mean, it's crazy, man. It's crazy to think that someone would say that there wasn't anything, you know, out of the ordinary that a 14-year-old boy couldn't do. I guess a 14-year-old boy could learn Latin and could scratch himself up, but how likely is that really?
Yeah, I mean, and there were also other things where they said, you know, of course, like we were talking about how crucifixes would come off the walls and all this other stuff. Obviously, he can't do anything if he's tied to a bed. And then there was also a point where priests had actually reported that Roland had known conversations that the priests had in private, not even near him, in a completely different place. And Roland knew their conversations.
Yeah, that's see right there, man. I mean, that's some freaky stuff, man.
Yeah. And then after when they were going through the main, you know, exorcisms, there was a point where he had told the priest, he goes, you know, you're not doing this right. You're leaving out a word. And then after a while, when the priest, you know, the priests were like, what did he mean by that? Why was he saying that? And then, listen, I don't know how the priest would leave out this word, but somehow the priest was leaving out the word Lord out of the prayers. Yeah. I don't know how you can leave that out. Of all words, how could you leave that out?
He probably wasn't fluent in Latin.
But he was leaving that out and Roland knew it.
Yeah.
Or that's this entity or this demon, whatever, knew it. You know, I mean, it's just, it's fascinating. It really is. You know, I wish there was more that we could even have found out, you know, or that we could somehow talk to somebody. I mean, obviously this was a long, long time ago, so it's hard to find anybody that's probably still around that was, you know, that dealt with it or that it would even want to talk about it, really. But it's super fascinating, man.
It is.
Especially since, I mean, this is what sparked The Exorcist.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, due to the big scene in The Exorcist when she projectile vomits, that actually happened too. Not obviously the way that they showed it in the movie, but he did projectile vomit as well.
Was it pea soup, I wonder?
I don't believe it was pea soup. No. I don't think so.
That movie made me never want to eat pea soup again. I'm like, if that's what pea soup looks like, man, I'm done. I'm good.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's funny because that's still one of those movies that, like, I'm 44 years old, man. And I sometimes, I'll be sitting at home and it'll be on and be like, yeah, I can't do this tonight. I can't watch this tonight. This is not a good movie to watch.
It's a great movie, man. I mean, it. I loved it. So what I find most fascinating about this case is the afterwards. So yeah, he did live a normal life, a really normal life, but I'm making some connections here that really, when I learned about what he actually did as an adult, blew me away. It blew me away. And this is probably going to be not necessarily his role in this, but I think that we should do an episode on this other thing that I'm about to touch on right now. Because, you know, after he was, let's just call him Roland, because I guess he's got like 18 different names, man. So the real guy, his real name, he became a NASA engineer afterwards.
Really?
And yeah, but listen, Joe, this blew me away, man. Because I'm like, of course he became a NASA engineer. Of course he did. You know all the occult stuff that's behind NASA? I mean, do you know Jack Parsons?
Yeah.
Jack Parsons pretty much started Jet Propulsion Laboratories. And he was a huge, huge, huge occultist. Huge. I'm talking Aleister Crowley level. Him and Aleister Crowley were really good friends. And he was his disciple.
Wow.
And you know, Jack and Aleister used to go out into the into the desert and call demons, try to call demons and do all kinds of crazy stuff. With L. Ron Hubbard from Scientology, which is crazy. Those three were all big buddies together. So
that's crazy.
I started thinking about this and I'm like, I didn't know he was a NASA engineer. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, ding, 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 ding. Of course he's a NASA engineer. This dude was possessed by a demon, man. Like it just, I don't know. I may be reaching, Joe, but it blew me away, man. It blew me away. I'm like, of course he got a job there. You know what I mean? Because
right.
How fascinating is that for them? Because I think there's still some occult stuff going on with NASA, especially back when he was, working for them, you know? And it blew me away, man. I don't know. Like, it's just weird that he ended up with NASA.
I guess it's almost like when the government hires hackers that had hacked into government, you know, government agencies, they end up hiring them instead of putting them in jail. You know, I guess it's the same type of thing. Like, well, who better to hire than this guy that kind of experienced some crazy otherworldly stuff?
Yeah, man.
That's pretty fascinating. I actually didn't know that about him. I couldn't really find much about his adult life.
Yeah, he worked for NASA
for
30 years, man. Wow. He died in 2020.
Yeah, not too long ago.
Yeah, so it's like, I don't know, that blew me away. But that is definitely, in my opinion, a subject or an episode that we should do is all the Jack Parsons, L. Ron Hubbard, Aleister Crowley stuff, because it's fascinating, man. And it blows me away that it's kind of like Scientology is now. And I know I don't want to talk much about religion, but, you know, a lot of those people were elitists, you know what I mean? That are in Scientology. And it's weird. I don't even like to call it a religion because I don't really think that it is. It's just a weird thing, you know? It's just crazy how, like, there's so many actresses, that are in that religion in it. And it's really a pretty occult religion, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Look at the big man of it. You know, Tom Cruise is the poster boy for Scientology. Yeah. You know, Leah Remini escaped from Scientology. She was involved in it. And, you know, she ended up getting away from it and was talking, you know, crazy stuff about how they were and everything. We don't want to get into religion and stuff like that. I mean, did you even hear that I remember years ago, you know, because going to Barnes & Noble when you were younger and stuff and going to the paranormal section. There used to be quite a large paranormal section in Barnes & Noble. And I remember there was a book on a religion that was the god of the religion was the flying spaghetti monster.
Oh, now I might have to check this one out. Spaghetti, man.
I mean, hey, I'm Italian, so I could get behind that god, you know.
Meatballs down everywhere. I don't know if I'm gonna be eating meatballs from a spaghetti god or anything, because I don't really know where them things have been.
but yeah, man. I mean, yeah, I think we should definitely probably touch on something like that too, without getting too crazy about religion, but maybe going into some of that stuff, you know, the lore of it and, you know, I guess some of the people that are involved in it, you know, without getting targets on our backs, I guess.
I think a lot of that stuff's connected. I really think a lot of that's connected, even to the point of what I just said about Roland Doe becoming a NASA engineer. You know, like I really feel like that's a connection. It may not be, I may be reaching, but in my opinion, just seeing that, I was like, whoa, like this really, out of all the things this dude could have done, he went to possibly at that time, now I'm not saying NASA still is, but one of the most cultish, I guess you would say, companies or whatever on the face of the earth at the time, because the guy that was running it at the time was Jack Parsons, you know?
Actually, I wanted to talk on this too, because since we were talking about the Roland Doe case and pretty much what happened in kind of a succession, I wanted to go into a little bit about the four stages of demonic possession. So the first one is called infestation. And that's kind of the initial thing where from Roland Doe's thing, that's with the water dripping and the scratches and stuff like that. That's infestation. That's how, you know, it kind of starts. And then oppression is the second stage where that's when it targets a specific person. Normally it's a person that's, you know, not weak, but somebody that may have some kind of emotional distress. And Roland Doe was upset about his aunt. And he was also into the spiritual aspect of things as well. And then you have obsession. That's the third stage where you start the person that's affected by it starts having intrusive thoughts, paranoia, the feeling of possibly trying to, I'm going to say it like this, you know, the TikTok way of possibly trying to unalive themselves. And and stuff like that. It's obsession. They have all these intrusive thoughts, maybe trying, you know, thinking about unaliving somebody else, you know, or stuff like that. And then the fourth stage is possession. And that's pretty much where he was at. That's direct control, you know, leading to drastic personality changes, unnatural strength. I mean, this kid broke the restraints that were on him and tore a spring from the mattress and cut one of the priests with the spring. I mean, a regular 14-year-old cannot do that. I mean, that's, I don't know. I mean, I know I can't pull off a spring from a box spring, you know.
I mean, he was tied to a chair and he broke the chair. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And they said he didn't even fall backwards on it and he broke it. It was, crazy stuff.
And there are cases and there are reports of him levitating as well, just like in the movie too. They had said towards the end there when it was getting really, really bad, they said that he actually had levitated over the bed as well. It's still restrained. So he was, he was levitating up until, I guess, the restraints, were holding him down. But yeah, that's not something that, a normal kid could do.
No, I haven't. I've never seen a kid fly or float or levitate or
No. Anything. Except for that one time. But other than that one time.
Yeah. I was gone though. I didn't wait around for it.
Right. But yeah, man. I mean, it's such an interesting case. And I definitely, maybe we should delve deeper into the Annalise Michelle one as well, because that's an insane case as well.
It is.
I mean, there's plenty of these kinds of cases. Listen, if you guys have any kind of paranormal experience that you'd like to share or questions or comments, or if you have an idea of something that we could talk about, give us a call at 845-600-0744. Let us know about it. You could email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You could do it anonymously. You could leave a voicemail. You could just type it. And, we'll there's no judgment as usual. And we'll put it out there, because that's what I like to do with this podcast, is kind of bring people together. And, I feel like the paranormal community, it is a community. And I think everybody should be together with it, and we should all be trying to figure out what's going on. And if we can't figure it out, at least we could talk about it with each other, without judgment.
And who knows, maybe you will figure it out just by talking to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree.
So before we wrap this up, we're going to check in with Edgegrave Dave and his awesome, horrible review on Friday the 13th, Part 7, A New Blood, and his excellent tribute to Final Girl, Laura Park Lincoln.
Horrible Review with Edgegrave Dave.
There's a legend around here. A killer buried, but not dead. They say he died as a boy, but he keeps coming back. Few have seen him and lived. Some have even tried to stop him. No one can. And Edgegrave Dave here, that is one of the finest openings to any horror movie that I have ever seen, almost bar none. And of course, the film that I am referring to is 1988's Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. Edgegrave Dave is so excited to be talking about one of two movies that created the ever-loving horror fun maniac that I am. It was this movie, Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood, and the movie that came out the year prior, 1987, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors. Not to mention walking in on the James Bond opening to Part 6, Jason Lives, when my father watched it on the TV, and my grandfather had seen it too. Man, when I first saw Jason Voorhees look in that movie on the TV with all the commercials and the ultra-edited footage, because, hey, back then around Halloween, horror films used to play on the regular TV. I knew that something special was going on. Little kid me realize 1988 was quite the year for horror and for horror movie sequels. We had both Halloween 4 and A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, respectfully, come out that year. We had Hellraiser 2 that year, Phantasm 2, Fright Night Part 2, and so many others. We also had The Birth of Chucky. Child's Play came out in 1988. What a culmination, in a way, of 80s horror. I know that I could say the same about 1989, but there is that magical spot that little did I realize. As a matter of fact, Jason was my Halloween costume in that year, and I was in grade number 4. But that was not the final chapter. Here we go. So being that there's only one Friday the 13th this year in 2025, I was originally going to do Fake Jason, Roy Burns, from Part 5, The New Beginning, as it's the 40th anniversary. But then the very sad news of one of Ghost Joe and my favorite final girl, Laura Park Lincoln, had just recently passed away from cancer. So sad. She made such an impact on this movie. So, Lar, this review is dedicated to you. She was also in a Friday the 13th fan film that I will mention at the very end of this review. At this time, I'm going to issue a very special Edge grave warning. Spoiler alert. Guys, there is just so much I could say about this movie, and I don't want to make this an Edge Grave Dave Part 7. But I have to tell you, although this film came out in 1988, this was the very beginning of Freddy versus Jason. You see, in 1986, 1987, Paramount Pictures tried to secure an agreement with New Line Cinema to make that film happen. We even had Lar in a Freddy's Nightmares episode in that same year, believe it or not. But that crossover did not happen until New Line Cinema ultimately secured the rights, and we got that one in 2003. So some of the facts that I'm going to tell you is that the director, Jean-Carl Butler, he directed this film, but he also did makeup work for Nightmare on Elm Street 4 from 1988 and Halloween 4 in 1988. Isn't that unbelievable? I mean, what a juggernaut. The only issue that we had is this is a year that the MPAA really cracked down on special effects and gore. I viewed this movie on an old school method of choice. I have a DVD box set from 2009. I actually love the look of each film that had come out as a special edition. And little did I realize there were 21 slashed scenes. Most of them being kills. Some of the kills in this movie have some of the most impact and fun of the series, like the sleeping bag kill. He was supposed to actually take the sleeping bag 6 times, and Kane Hodder was slipping out of his hand. There were buckets of blood. It splattered everywhere. This is the debut performance of Kane Hodder as Jason. And oh man, the look that they chose for this one, it's like every single terrible thing that ever happened to Jason was shown. When he was submerged underwater, That green shirt was all tattered, showing his ripped out spine. He was mostly bone at this point. This was also the culmination of the original hockey mask from part three that was missing at the bottom of his jaw. You could see his teeth moving around. He still had the chain that Tommy Jarvis had pulled down from the previous film in part six, and he just looked pure carnage. But the relish that he had in this movie, unfortunately, so many of the kills were just cut down. We didn't realize it back then. The flow of the movie goes so perfectly. But man, when you go back and see this raw, unedited footage, it is also on YouTube. You just won't believe some of the things that were left out. What always separated this film is that it was very different from the others, with an emotional, deep-grounded story. I always found it very interesting that they decided to end the Tommy Jarvis trilogy, which was parts 4 through 6, and Jason is still underwater in the lake from when Tommy Jarvis pulled that chain down. But here we have a girl with telekinetic psychic abilities, and for the first time, another villain other than Jason. And no, I ain't talking about Roy Burns. I'm talking about Dr. Cruz, played by Terry Kaiser, who I did have the chance to meet at one of the Monster Manias, actually. And he was in the Weekend at Bernie's films. In this emotional film, in many ways, you almost didn't even think about Jason in the beginning. You had this poor little girl named Tina Shepherd who, using her telekinetic abilities, accidentally kills her father. And he's standing on a dock and the whole thing collapses upon itself and he dies. And she's been in a mental hospital for so many years. And her mother and Dr. Cruz end up going back to the original house where she used to live. And all he wants to do is exploit her abilities. And all while this is happening, in the background, you have all the teenagers, because that's what this is all about. All the dumb characters, all the killing. But each one, they really did a good job in a little bit of character development. Somebody rents out their uncle's house, which just happens to be next door. I'm not quite sure where the camp is at this point. But if you go back to previous films, they renamed it to Camp Forest Green. I guess it's Crystal Lake again. The timelines has always been a little screwy, to say the least. And he rents out his uncle's house because it's Michael's surprise birthday. Yeah. Let's just say that Michael never makes it to the cabin. It's one of the first things that Jason does when he's resurrected is he actually goes a few miles away from Camp Crystal Lake and he kills him on the way to getting there along with his girlfriend. I always found that really funny. Funny that Jason actually leaves the campsite right away and he goes just a few miles down the road and in the forest. But then again, that's what Jason's always done. He doesn't want anybody where the camp was. And if he hadn't done that, we would not have had that awesome sleeping bag kill scene. And it also works that while Jason is away from the campsite, you have the serious drama of what's going on with Tina, Dr. Cruz, and her mother. And then it's switched and cut scenes back and forth to what the teenagers are doing in the house while they're smoking some dope, while they're having a little bit of attractive love triangle stuff going on, and some of the ridiculous dialogue, because you need that balance. And that's one thing I thought that this film did very well, was having that balance. When it's time to get scary, those scenes were really meaningful and they meant something. When you have your dialogue, that kind of calmed you down. And then Tina and all of her main scenes, it's just great how you had three different things going on. The formula, in a way, of Friday the 13th, the new story between Tina, her mother, and the doctor. And then you have what you're used to with the teenagers. In many ways, I think that this film broke new ground while retaining something that was kind of charming and you'd come to expect. But what you didn't come to expect was the incredible special effects extravaganza between the final showdown of Tina versus Jason. I don't want to give too much of that away, but I will tell you, you get to see Jason's face unmasked, in my opinion, more times than any other film in the series. And it looks so damn cool with those teeth and that zombie head and his tattered, ripped up, zombified body. Like I said before, it just looked so awesome. And Kane Hodder had to catch fire for quite a long time. I know that other actors in the Jason series have done that too, but much respect for how long that he had held that. The anger and carnage that Kane Hodder displayed as Jason was just unbelievable in this movie. He is the only actor to reprise the character for more than one film. And it's definitely no surprise. He was just excellent. You can just feel it right under that rubber suit and mask. Ah, the fun part. What to rate this movie, or maybe the not so fun part, because even though this is one of my most favorite Jason movies, I think Jason Lives in Part 6 is still my favorite, and it's a comforting childhood memory, and I think that it's one of the most exciting films. I'm going to go ahead and rate this one about a 3.5 to 4 out of 5 graves. It's definitely in the middle, and these are the reasons why. Something that the director himself had said is that you spend all this time to build up a story. You have all these perfectly crafted kills, and then Jason basically just gets pulled back down to the lake by some guy. And that guy is Tina's father that she does bring back for 2 seconds, and he looks like the most normal guy, like it just happened. It's been, what, 10 years? They had an alternate slash scene where he really looked like a zombie himself, and it was really cool. I mean, don't get me wrong. They did a lot to Jason to try to bring him down. But ultimately, going back in the lake, maybe that's where he belongs. For all the time that they spent on the story, I would have to say that the gore and the sex scenes were really cut down a lot. I mean, they did want to avoid an X rating, and they didn't want to have certain things shown. But damn, looking at that final product once again, it was cut away quite a lot. And I do have to say, though, this has one of the most amazing soundtracks that I've ever heard. And maybe the whole series, this in Part 6, I would say, really captures a lot of emotion. Harry Manfredini, it was such a joy to listen to this soundtrack. But here are 7 things that you might not have known about Friday the 13th, Part 7, The New Blood. That opening scene, the heart of it being in the graveyard, was actually the trailer that was used for Part 6, Jason Lives. Jason's tool belt seems to be missing when you submerge underwater, and his yellow gloves disappear. But hello, power tools! I guess you went to the Home Depot or Lowe's. The axe killing from Melissa, that is the NES cover to our game. There it is. That's where they got it from. Did you know that they went back to the original Tommy Jarvis house that was shot in California for Robin's death when she was thrown out the window? But not only was she thrown the other way towards the bed, the person that comes out and dies is actually a male stunt double with a wig. Huh, nice legs. We get to see Ted White's name finally used in the credits. He is Jason from Part 4, The Final Chapter. At that time, he had made the decision not to be named, and now we do have his name. This film, in 1988, is 88 minutes long. And finally, the story did continue as a 2021 fan film, Friday the 13th, Roseblood, where you get to see the Crystal Lake Research Facility that was in Jason X. And that is where the sleeping bag kill does show its face again. They had some fun with that in Jason X. And in this fan film, the bounty hunter Duke from Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, is shown. The film does expand when Tina does go back, Nick returns, and so does Dr. Cruz. I really do have to check this one out. So happy Friday the 13th. Go ahead and check out Friday the 13th, New Blood, because checking out of the mental hospital was the best thing that Tina Shepherd ever did to bring back Jason and have him return to the lake once again. Back to you, Ghost Joe.
I hope you guys enjoyed the show. Again, 845-600-0744. We're on all of the platforms, TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and all that stuff. And there's going to be a lot more stuff coming out with all that too. Hope you guys are going to enjoy it.
They can reach me at creepyken@gmail.com. No, I'm joking. Don't send an email there.
See, now you're going to make that name stick now. See, now you've done it because you said Creepy Ken. Now it's, see, if I was going to come up with a name, I was going to say Killer Ken, but you wanted Creepy Ken, I guess.
Ken, you know, I mean, Killer Ken just sets me up for one thing.
So, all right, everybody, thanks for joining us and we'll see you next week. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. So check everything out and we'll talk to you guys next time. Later.
Thank you for listening to the Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast, and thank you to all of my guests and contributors that helped make this show possible. If you have a paranormal experience you'd like to share, questions, comments, or you'd like to be a guest in the show, please leave me a voicemail at 845-600-0744, or you can email me at ghostjoeny@gmail.com. You can do so anonymously if you'd like. Also, please check out our show notes for all social media links of this show and some of our friends. The Warp Reality Paranormal Podcast, uncovering the unseen.